Many of Arizona's elected officials have become well-known national names over the decades, like Barry Goldwater, John McCain, and Janet Napolitano. I'm Steve Goldstein. On this Veterans Day-themed edition of Here and Now, we'll talk about Ernest McFarland, who served as Arizona governor, chief justice of the state Supreme Court, and majority leader of the U.S. Senate. McFarland is also known as the father of the GI Bill. Plus, the working relationship between Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon has never been considered a great one. In his new book, The President and the Apprentice, historian Irwin Gelman writes about the ways in which Eisenhower and Nixon learned from each other and had an impact on the federal government. Also, Valley resident Anne A. Wilson had her first novel published earlier this year. It's called Hover and is based on her experience as one of only a few female Navy pilots. I'll talk with Wilson about her days in the military and the transition to being an author. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll have a number of Veterans Day-themed conversations. I'll talk with some relatives of former Arizona Governor Ernest McFarland. He was also Chief Justice of the Arizona Supreme Court and the Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate. He's also been called the father of the GI Bill. I'll also speak with novelist Anne A. Wilson. Her first published book, Hover, is influenced in part by her previous career as a Navy pilot. And Robert Cunningham will tell us about his experience as an embedded war photographer. We start today's program by looking back at last night's Republican presidential debate. Now that we're edging closer to the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, who's gaining momentum and what are the issues drawing the most attention? To talk about that, I'm joined by political consultant Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Barrett, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So, did you learn anything new about the candidates last night? Was there any momentum shift at all?
I don't know if there was a momentum shift, but I definitely learned Ben Carson is a napper. It just seemed he was taking a nap. Even when he was speaking, his eyes were closed half the time. I found that both annoying and I thought that it showed that his, when, you know, you really started to talk about policy, his lack of knowledge. So I know that he's, you know, leading in a lot of the polls, but I really didn't hear a lot of good specifics from him. He still had the I'm a feel-good kind of guy. But you want to talk about low energy, that's the guy who really feels asleep, not just puts you to sleep.
Yeah, and some, I guess some would see that as that he's calm and that's soothing, but at the same time, it probably doesn't engender a lot of confidence.
No, it really didn't. I obviously, Marco Rubio had a really good evening, and so did Ted Cruz. And despite the fact that John Kasich got about the most amount of time, it was time not well used. You know, a couple of his answers, I'm still trying to figure out whether he would bail out banks or not. His answer was very confusing, and I really didn't get what he was trying to say. So he got a lot of time, but he did not use it well.
So we heard what you thought of Ben Carson. Now, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, the polls indicate that they're still doing quite well. They're still the leaders, and Marco Rubio seems to be, if we want to call an establishment candidate, he's probably tops when it comes to that, someone who's actually holding elected office. Are you surprised that, okay, we haven't taken official votes yet, and we talk about these things frequently because of the debates so far, but we are getting closer and closer. I mean, the Iowa caucuses are only about 2 months away now. Are you surprised Trump and Carson are still leading the polls?
You know, I'm somewhat surprised, particularly about Ben Carson. I really think that Trump is going to be there at least until the March timeframe. He still has that great name recognition. But when it does come time to vote, for people to actually start voting, they are going to give people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz serious looks. But Trump will still have his 20-25%, which is substantial when you have a 15-person field.
Now, the emphasis of last night's debate being on the Fox Business Network was mostly on the economy, or at least it sort of started out that way. Did you learn anything? You mentioned about Kasich's answer being sort of strange, but when it comes to actual business people, which Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina have been, did they give better answers on the economy than anybody else did?
Actually, they really didn't. Carly Fiorina's big push was, let's take back our government. And, you know, Trump is always about himself and what he's going to do and how he's going to make America great again, but he doesn't give you any real specifics. I thought there was some good talk about tax plans, tax reform, that some of the candidates gave really specific answers and defended their tax plans against questions. the moderators last night, unlike the CNBC debate earlier, a couple weeks ago, these moderators, they didn't ask tough questions, but they still talked about policy. I thought it was one of the better debates about policy that we've had so far. The candidates actually talked about things that they wanted to do, maybe sans Ben Carson and Donald Trump, but they talked a lot about where they, how they would get to the places that they wanted to go to at least make, paraphrase Donald Trump, make America great again. So I really enjoyed hearing a lot of the specifics from candidates like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, and even, you know, a little bit of Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush had probably his best debate night. I just don't know that that was enough.
And the earlier debate had Governor Bobby Jindal teeing off on Governor Chris Christie, I guess, as they sort of battle each other to find out who can make it back to the initial earlier debate, which Chris Christie, of course, had been involved in. We've still got double-digit candidates right now, Barrett. When you think about, I don't know, again, I don't want to make this too much of a horse race because I know listeners can sometimes get tired of that, but if you were to say who your top five are going to be by January, would any of them come from the earlier debate?
Only Chris Christie. I think that he should be elevated up to the big boy debate because he is an excellent debater. I think he showed that. He has shown that time and again. I know his poll numbers are sagging, or I don't even know if sagging is the right word, but he is somebody who, you know, can do well in a debate, who is popular, who, you know, a year or 2 years ago was looked at as someone who could be the nominee. Obviously, he's had some issues in his home state, but he certainly can really dominate a stage. Someone like Bobby Jindal cannot. Someone like Governor Huckabee cannot. Those guys, you know, should be, there should only be one debate next time, and it probably should feature eight or nine people. Rand Paul really distinguished himself last night. I just don't know if it in a good way. In a Republican primary, I'm not sure if it's good to talk about less defense spending.
And Barrett, time for one more question, maybe less than a minute answer if you can here. Issues. Is there an issue? Are there two issues that might separate the candidates once we get down to really talking about, rather than platitudes, really talking about plans?
You know, I think illegal immigration, which is big, obviously, in Arizona, but it's an issue across the country. But it was interesting when some people talked about, hey, it's too difficult to deport 11 million people. And that is an interesting component of the debate that I think should be fleshed out. And so I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. Also, the candidates' plans for global terrorism, ISIS in specific. You know, they talked a little bit about that last night, and Ben Carson's answer was atrocious. So he's going to have to get better on that. He's going to have to get better on foreign policy. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the other candidates as well.
And political consultant Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Barrett, thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. On Tuesday, the Arizona Lodging and Tourism Association and the Valley Hotel and Resort Association named its new president and CEO. Kim Sabo is leaving a position she held with the Arizona-Mexico Commission for the new job. She's succeeding Debbie Johnson, who left to lead the Arizona Office of Tourism. Joining me for a few minutes to put these moves into context is Phoenix Business Journal reporter Stephen Totten. Stephen, good morning.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So before we get to Kim Sabo's background, how significant is the job she's taking as it relates to Arizona's broader tourism industry?
Well, as I'm sure you know, the tourism industry in Arizona is one of the largest industries in the state. And beyond the Arizona Office of Tourism, the Arizona Lodging and Tourism Association is essentially the biggest force in the tourism industry here in Arizona. They're a leading public policy advocate for anything going on with tourism in the state.
And so tourism in the state, I think sometimes people think it takes care of themselves, but apparently we need these organizations to let people know what's going on here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we need to attract outside visitors, outside investors and businesses, making sure that we're still getting major revenue from the tourism industry.
Now, a moment ago, I mentioned that Kim Sabo is leaving the position she held with the Arizona-Mexico Commission. What should we know about her background as far as what experience she has in Arizona as it relates to tourism or anything else?
Well, as far as Arizona, Kim Sabo has been in the political realm for a number of years. She's actually served on three gubernatorial administrations, Jan Brewer's, Five Symington's, and then most recently Doug Ducey's. As you mentioned, she was the executive director of the Arizona-Mexico Commission, and she was really responsible for improving Arizona and Mexico's relations, especially after a lot of the controversy in 2010 with SB 1070. So she has also been assistant vice president of state relations for the University of Arizona. So overall, Sabo has been in the political realm for a while, and she is very, very heavily connected.
And as we mentioned, the Arizona-Mexico Commission, you mentioned that that's received considerable emphasis with Kim Sabo there and from Doug Ducey. How significant do you think it is that Kim Sabo is leaving that? Obviously, Mexico continues to be an important trading partner for Arizona.
Sure, and that's very true. And, you know, she was a large part in establishing those relations. She visited Mexico for the first time when Ducey first visited. She also visited again when Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton made his first trip. And then, as I'm sure you know, the City of Nogales, the Intertribal Council of Arizona, and the Maricopa Association of Governments are working to expand the border zone from Mexico for visitors who have border crossing cards to kind of improve shopping and visiting from Mexico tourists. So that'll still play an essential role going on, and I'm sure in one aspect or another, Sabo's new position with the Arizona Lodging and Tourism Association may play into that.
Yeah, maybe we'll see more emphasis on tourism to and from Mexico, perhaps.
That could definitely be the fact, although I did speak with Arizona Lodging and Tourism Association Chairman Ken McKenzie, and while he did acknowledge that Sabo's done great work with the Arizona-Mexico Commission, he did say the largest attraction of her hiring was her previous political connections.
And Stephen, one last question for you. Last month, Kristen Jarnagin, who was also heavily involved with the Lodging and Tourism Association, moved to New York for a new job. Do these changes indicate anything to be concerned about, or is the tourism industry in Arizona still in a very strong position?
Well, the Arizona Lodging and Tourism Association had actually been void of a CEO since Debbie Johnson left for the Arizona Office of Tourism for several months. And so Jarnagin's recent departure may have raised some heads, but now that we have Sabo in here, considering her work with the Arizona government for so long, everything will most likely be fine. I mean, last year, Arizona tourism collectively brought in almost $21 billion. And, you know, with big events like the NCAA Final Four coming to the Valley, we should probably be fine.
Phoenix Business Journal reporter Stephen Totten. Stephen, thanks for talking about tourism with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet some members of the family of Ernest McFarland, former Arizona senator, who's the father of the GI Bill. That's one of his many nicknames. And then also later on this hour, we'll meet Navy pilot turned novelist Ann A. Wilson. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Landings Credit Union, helping kids learn about money with youth accounts, because one day they'll need a car loan, a credit card, and a mortgage for a new home. LandingsCU.org. Landings Credit Union. Banking with purpose.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us today at 1 for NewsHour from the BBC. Mostly sunny and clear across Arizona right now. It's 57 degrees in Tucson, 57 in Casa Grande as well. Down in Yuma, clear sky, 67 degrees. It's sunny and 44 in Flagstaff, 36 in Flagstaff rather, 44 degrees right now in Prescott. Well, your car has given you years of good service. Why not let it do one final good deed by donating it to KJZZ? Your vehicle will help pay for your favorite programs, and you'll receive free towing and a tax deduction. Find out more at cars.kjzz.org. Right now in Phoenix, with 28% relative humidity, skies are fair, and it's 60 degrees at 11:20.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Consider some of Arizona's best-known politicians and elected officials. The names that most often come to mind are Barry Goldwater, Carl Hayden, Mo Udall, and in more recent days, John McCain, Bruce Babbitt, Janet Napolitano. But only one person held three of the highest offices, Ernest McFarland. He was elected governor of Arizona. He was also Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, and he served as the U.S. Senate's majority leader as well. McFarland's greatest accomplishment as a senator was likely his work creating the GI Bill after World War II. So to mark that, and to talk about a refurbished memorial for McFarland at the state capitol in Phoenix, I'm joined by two of McFarland's grandchildren, John Lewis and Kara Lynn Lewis, Kara Lewis's husband, Fritz Aspie, and historian Vince Murray. Vince, let me start with you. When you think about names like Barry Goldwater, Carl Hayden, Ernest McFarland accomplished a tremendous amount and was elected to these major positions. Is he someone who doesn't get enough attention? Is he ignored in some ways?
Well, you mentioned Carl Hayden, and one of the quotes that people are most familiar with Carl Hayden is, when you become a public servant, you can be a workhorse or a show horse. And in this instance, you have a person who was truly a workhorse. He was a senator, and as a senator, he worked really hard to deal with the issue of World War II with the GIs. He also was instrumental in getting the same educational and loan benefits for the Korean War veterans as well. That was one of the last things that he did while he was still in office. As governor, in a similar way, he came in seeing that Arizona was getting a little bit behind what was really going on in the United States. So he was instrumental in getting tax incentives put together to bring businesses to Arizona, a lot of them high-tech businesses. Sperry Rand would be one of them, who came in right afterwards. The idea being, then, taking these tax benefits, you would have people that would want to come work for these businesses, and they would be then in turn employing people, bringing in income tax, building houses, building properties, bringing in property taxes, and it worked quite effectively for them. As a Supreme Court justice, he was a little bit different there. You don't really see so much coming back on what the impact was that he had, but he was elected to that position. And here was a person who had been in law, had really made law his career, and that to him was the ultimate achievement that he could make. And taking it seriously as being an elected official, he wrote over 300 opinions within the term that he was there, averaging over 50 a year.
Wow.
And he was just a diehard person, coming into work early in the morning, working in the evenings. If you ever talked to people who worked in his staff, they thought it was just incredible, the types of things that he was doing, and he was very consistent, and then he was quite proud of that. And here's a guy who literally started off born in a one-room cabin kind of thing, coming to Arizona with $10 in his pocket, and becomes quite successful. But in turn, his success made success easier for other people, too. That's why we talk about this issue of the American dream not being something about homeownership, but more being the capability of being all you can be. And that's what he was actually creating in the process of doing these things.
Mm-hmm. Was there a certain family connection to the military? Was there a particular reason he thought this was so important?
The veterans who returned really had very little options. In fact, Mac actually didn't serve in the war itself. He became sick while he was still in what was called kind of a boot camp back then. But if you were to look at what happened with the veterans, and probably the greatest injustice was Anacostia Flats outside of Washington, D.C., where they camped out and were trying to get their benefits, and they weren't able to, and literally the military came and ran them off.
Mm.
And that was one of the things that he said when he was working on the GI Bill, was we can't let something like Anacostia Flats happen again. We have to have something for these guys to come back to. And when you look at the number of people that served in World War I compared to World War II, you had 12 million service people coming back, the majority of them men, of course, but they were coming back to really nothing. I mean, there was no jobs, there were no benefits that they could see. And while you had the American Legion and other entities working on making sure that they had health benefits, there were no jobs. There were none of these other things. So basically what he had put together was, if you came back, you could go to college, you could go to a trade school, you could get a loan with the government covering it for a low interest rate for a house or to start a business. So now these guys actually had something to look forward to when they came back. And so there were two things. He wanted to see that the veterans didn't have something bad happen to them, like Anacostia Flats. But he also didn't want to see us go back into a depression again with truly 12 million unemployed people coming all back into the market at once.
And John and Carol, what is it like to have a grandfather with this kind of legacy? I mean, how does it feel to know that all these decades later, this impact that your grandfather had is still really felt?
The thing about my grandfather that really strikes me is what a hard worker he was. My God, that guy would work. And he just wouldn't give up on things and kept going and going. And if you look at his life, all of those themes were reflected through many parts of his life. You know, losing the Senate seat, okay, I can go be governor. Okay, he's done with that. All right, I'll be a judge. And he just never gave up. And for us, building that memorial, it was a lot of work for us. Vince and I had to go down and look and count all of his rulings, because we came across literature that said Ernest McFarland made over 300 opinions. Mm-hmm. Well, is that 301 or is that 399? Well, we counted them. It's 315. And we had to know those things. And as his grandson, he instilled real hard work ethic in me. To know him personally, he was always a very honest man and wanted to do the right thing. He also didn't really care that much. Vince talked earlier about the workhorse and the show horse. Mm-hmm. He, to me, was the workhorse. And the other thing about this workhorse, Ernest McFarland, he didn't care that much about who got attention. He wanted to get things done. And he wanted to make a change. And he was focused on what he was doing, how to make our nation better, how to make Arizona better. And he wasn't out pounding his chest and like what you see so much today.
Fritz, I don't want to leave you out. Is there a...
You know, I'm a lawyer, and so I guess the angle of vision that I bring to this discussion is from a lawyer's perspective. I was very impressed when I learned that he had written 315 Arizona Supreme Court opinions. But his career was even greater than that. He served as a assistant attorney general, a county attorney, a superior court judge, as we've discussed, the chief justice of the Supreme Court. And in one remarkable instance, he actually, when he was governor, went back to the United States Supreme Court and argued a very famous water law case, California versus Arizona. And that's just unheard of. You know, no governor does that. Mac did. And so he was an extraordinary person. He was very instrumental in getting the CAP.
Is there something that stands out about the memorial in particular? If people go down to the Capitol and they see it and they just have a couple of minutes, they're just sort of passing by, but they want to take a quick stop. John, is there something for you that really stands out that you would say, please take this away from what you see? Is there a takeaway that you would really like people to have?
Hopefully you'll have a little bit more than a few minutes, but Vince, the Don Ryden, our historical architect, designed a lot of the ways to tell this story where you can walk in, you can look at pictures, you can read these caption type kind of in poetic form. And then if you're the type that really wants the nuts and bolts and the hard facts, look down at the bottom of the interpretive panels, and there's a timeline that tells you a lot. So it was designed for people with however much you want to get out of this. It's a beautiful arch that you get to walk under. The arch encapsulates the American flag that's off the USS Arizona Memorial, and that American flag is the symbol of the country that allows us to have an American dream. I know a lot of people are kind of debating if the American dream's dead or not, but in school and back then it was, and this really helped. And yeah, it's a lot of work went into it, and I'm very proud the way it turned out, and I like the way it looks, and just very happy that we could do this.
Kara, same thing for you. Yeah,
I have a lot of memories of family. He's just a fabulous family man, and I even brought a picture too.
Yeah, describe the picture for us. Yeah,
my mom and dad, Grammy and Mac, myself, and Bill. I don't think you were born yet, John. But it's really, he was a fabulous family man. He'd come down they'd come down every Saturday and check on the farm and meet with, you know, do farm business.
And Fritz, any final thoughts?
Yeah, you were asking questions about the memorial. One thing that I think is kind of neat about the memorial, there's a water pump there. Which is interesting. There's a little saying there that you know, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting, or words to that effect. And I think that memorializes Mac's effort to preserve water rights in Arizona. And so it's got a lot of interesting things, a lot of aspects to the memorial that are really well thought out.
Yeah, from the GI Bill to the Central Arizona Project, really, really amazing. Vince, final few seconds?
So the one thing, you know, I would like the listeners to take away from this is that, you know, as the true public servant of Mac, as, you know, we've said, he was governor, he was a Supreme Court justice, he was a senator, he preferred to be called Mac. That was the thing. Even his grandchildren referred to him as mm-hmm. Mac. Everybody pretty much called him Mac, and he was even chastised when he became a Supreme Court justice on his emphasis of being called Mac. Lorna Lockwood, who was the chief justice at the time, basically said, "Look, you're a Supreme Court justice. They have to refer to you as that. They have to stop calling you Mac, at least while you're in the courtroom."
That was historian Vince Murray, along with Fritz Aspe, Kara Lynn Lewis, and John Lewis. We've been marking Veterans Day by talking about former Arizona Governor Ernest McFarland, who was instrumental in creating the GI Bill when he was U.S. Senate Majority Leader. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Next fall, we'll be talking about the presidential candidates and their running mates in the 2016 general election. In his new book, The President and the Apprentice, historian Irwin Gelman looks back at the two terms Dwight Eisenhower served as president, with Richard Nixon as his vice president. Now, Irwin, you write about what you call misperceptions in the relationship between Eisenhower and Nixon. What were some of those misperceptions?
Probably the biggest thing is that Eisenhower and Nixon did not get along. I don't really believe that Eisenhower, you know, was all that much interested in, for want of a better word, his lieutenants. It wasn't so much that they got along, which they did. It was, could they perform well? And as Eisenhower moved from running for president in 1962 and the problems over the fund crisis and the Checker speech until the end of his second term, he depended more and more and more on Nixon for advice, and he thought higher and higher of him.
Did some of that have to do with the fact that even though he had been a public figure for a long time, that Eisenhower was not a politician, that Nixon knew more of the ins and outs of what was going on in Washington?
I think you're correct there. I'll give you, you know, the prime example. Eisenhower was a military man. It's no surprise he was a five-star general. And what happened was, as you are moving up the chain of command in the Army, you may have the same rank, but you are moved from this job to that job to the next job because each job entailed different things and demonstrated certain skills that you needed to hone. In Eisenhower's case, at the end of the first term, he suggested that Nixon become a Secretary of Defense. Eisenhower understood that Nixon needed training in management. He didn't understand that if Nixon dropped out of the vice presidency and became Secretary of Defense, it would hurt Nixon politically. Eisenhower just didn't understand the nature of how politics worked in many, many arenas.
What did Nixon want, other than the idea of obviously being vice president, you're the so-called heartbeat away from the presidency? What is it that Nixon wanted out of being vice president? Was there something that Nixon was looking to do other than career advancement? Was there something in particular he thought he could learn from that job, learn from Eisenhower?
You know, the way you phrase it is really kind of interesting. Everything that Nixon did because of his early career and people writing him that eventually you would become president affected him. And what his basic role as vice president was, and this was early in the administration, was to get more and more experience and more issues that Eisenhower gave him to take care of. Example, Eisenhower made Nixon early on in August of 1953 the chair of the president's Committee on Government Contract, was a euphemistic way of saying get African-American jobs. Eisenhower did more for the advancement of civil rights as far as speaking publicly than anyone in the United States.
What was his motivation for that?
I think it was two. One, he was looking for more blacks to return to the party of Lincoln. And two, he thought it was right. And probably in between both of those, is as he became more and more knowledgeable in foreign affairs, and as he traveled more, at the height of the Cold War and the anti-communist sentiment and moving the United States as the greatness of democracy, he came to believe that if segregation continued in the United States, the United States could not preach around the world democracy because of the segregationist blot on democracy.
One of the key issues at points in the book, and one of the key issues of the 1950s, at least politically, was Senator Joseph McCarthy and Red Scare and whatnot. And Nixon and Eisenhower, at least it seemed, were approaching this quite differently as far as how they felt about McCarthy. Your book seems to indicate differently. What did you find out in your research?
Well, again, this is one of the great surprises about the research. The perceived wisdom is that Eisenhower sat back and did nothing in regard to McCarthy, and Nixon was a McCarthy clone. And nothing could be further from the truth. Eisenhower was the man behind the removal of McCarthy's power, and Nixon, as a team member for Eisenhower, went after McCarthy. And rather than to look at him as a comrade, he looked at him as being deleterious to the GOP.
One of the things that comes up a lot, especially now that we're in the midst of another presidential campaign, is whether candidates, we hear about how the Democrats tend to, in the primary, lean left because that's where their base is. Republicans in the primary lean right because that's where their base is. But we're never quite sure if that's really what these candidates believe or it's just to gather votes. Was that the feeling on Nixon as well, that Nixon perhaps publicly was inflexible as far as anti-communism was concerned, but in private, he was trying to think in a way that actually made more sense for the country? Was there a feeling that he was putting on a show in some ways in public, as many politicians do?
Your point is well taken. The fact is that nobody wrote Nixon's early speeches. He came out with a series of sentences that he did. He had no speechwriters early in his vice presidency. And so what he did was he went from given points to ad-libbing. And he ad-libbed because his audience, for want of a better word, hyped him up, juiced him up. He became more playing to the audience. But quite frankly, you know, when he sat in front of the National Security Council or private cabinet meetings, etc., he was a very good listener, and he was very measured in his comments. I think that you're kind of right and kind of wrong, as I think Nixon was kind of right and kind of wrong. He played to the audience that he thought he needed to play to. And at the same time, when for want of a better word, the marbles needed to be put on the table, he was very circumspect.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Irv Gelman, historian and author of The President and the Apprentice, Eisenhower and Nixon, 1952 to 1961. In terms of what people saw of President Nixon the time he was in office, were there things that harken back to things that stood out about his vice presidency, items that he might have learned from Eisenhower, or had he been a changed person by then, having lost a couple of elections?
The answer is yes to all of the above. He became the foreign policy president because of all the assignments that Eisenhower gave him. The remarkable thing about it was that nobody really has written any definitive stuff on Eisenhower and foreign affairs. So what scholars miss is that before any of these people, whether it was Secretary of State John Foster Dulles or any of the other people that were involved in foreign affairs, Eisenhower would brief them at the White House before they left, and then he would debrief them when he came back. Then he would listen to them at secret meetings in front of various agencies like the NSC and the cabinet. But it was his foreign policy, and Nixon really studied his feet. The other thing that you mentioned, the political stuff, Eisenhower always claimed that he was above the fray and never commented personally on any of his opponents. And that's true. The problem is with that is he told Nixon to comment publicly on people he did not like Adlai Stevenson and others. And Nixon became the lightning rod where people focused because you simply didn't go after the five-star general who was probably one of the most beloved people in the world.
But I'm struck by the fact that in, let's say, the last couple of decades, we've seen speculation about whether Colin Powell or Norman Schwarzkopf would run. Wesley Clark did actually run, a run that did not go very well. Is there something about Eisenhower that stood out? Have our times changed to the point where it's hard to imagine a general winning the presidency again? Because, again, Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf were very high-profile figures. Powell even became Secretary of State.
The question is provocative, but I've got to tell you, I found Eisenhower almost genius. Do you know he never held a battlefield command? He was basically an organizational guy. And the thing that made him a great or near great president was not so much that he was actively involved and going out there and being this I did this and I did that. He probably, of all the presidents I've studied, was the most comfortable guy in his own skin. And what he was able to do was to make decisions and not look back.
Now, the perception, at least, is that Nixon was someone who is not comfortable in his own skin. It's interesting when you mention that people thought he would be president at some point, and obviously he was a very prominent figure for a long time. But there's also the feeling that, you know, again, we hear these days about the question, what candidate would you want to sit down and have a beer with? And it doesn't seem like Nixon would have been that type. So what made him into the successful politician he became?
I don't know how many people would like to have a beer or even a glass of water with Nixon. He was very, very bad at small talk. What made him the politician he was incredibly driven. Most people that run for the president have to be, you know, a little myopic to run for the presidency because it's such a daunting task. And you have to be not thin-skinned in the sense that you aren't hurt because Nixon was very thin-skinned, and in many ways so was Eisenhower, but you got to be able to release that and go on the next day and the next day. And Nixon did that.
Historian Irwin Gelman, his new book about President Dwight Eisenhower and Vice President Richard Nixon, is called The President and the Apprentice. Still to come on this Veterans Day-themed edition of Here and Now, we'll talk with Navy pilot-turned-novelist and Fountain Hills resident Ann A. Wilson. We'll also meet embedded war photographer Robert Cunningham. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Citizens Clean Elections Commission, helping to take the guesswork out of voting. You can pledge to vote informed for the 2016 elections on the issues that matter most to you. Details at facebook.com/azcleanelections.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Well, we're looking for sunshine for this Veterans Day in the Valley, a high near 71 degrees, and about the same tomorrow, a little bit warmer, sunny skies, and a high of 76. We've got NPR's Here and Now coming up today at noon. Ahead of peace talks in Syria, Russia is floating a plan for constitutional reform in that country. And a conversation with former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels about affordability at public universities. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Right now, under fair skies, it's 60 degrees in Phoenix at 11:45.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Deciding to join the U.S. Naval Academy as a 17 or 18-year-old is a daunting choice for anyone, even someone who may have a family history of military service. What about the challenge when you're a young woman graduating from high school in the late 1980s, not too many years after women were first permitted to join the Naval Academy? Fountain Hills resident Anne A. Wilson had her first novel published in June. It's called Hover and is based on Wilson's experience as one of only a few female Navy pilots. As Wilson told me when we interviewed her back in the summer, the book begins with the protagonist, Sarah Denning, going through an intense training exercise.
The first pages take place in the Hilo Dunker, and that's a contraption that simulates a helicopter crash landing in the ocean. And all naval aviators and air crew have to ride this. And what they do is they strap you in, dunk you underwater, flip you upside down, and then on certain rides, you're wearing blackout goggles to simulate crashing at night, and then you have to escape from this apparatus. And so throughout the book, even the book's, it's a fictional novel. The plot is fictional. All the characters are fictional. But throughout, I put little tidbits like that that actually did happen to me. And so, yeah, the Hilo Dunker was one of them. That's not a fun experience.
Even the idea of whether you're a skilled pilot or not, the idea of the character and the not just the brain power, but the ability to have that mind over matter to deal with that. I mean, is that something that came naturally to you, or did the training really put that into you?
The training definitely helps put that into you, because everything is a procedure in the Navy. We certainly had it in the aircraft with flight procedures. You had to memorize entire sections that so you would be able to react automatically without having to think.
Was there an issue where it was harder for you to be accepted into this particular, you know, what people would think of as a fraternity, basically?
Right. Yeah. So with the class of 89, I was in the 10th graduating class of women. And so it was still new. We weren't the first by any means, but next year they're going to mark 40 years of women at the Service Academy. So we were on the front end, and I think the military was still trying to figure it out, like how to integrate us in. And there was a large contingent that felt that maybe women should not be at the Service Academy. So you felt that. But what I found most difficult really wasn't being a female at the academy. It was just being at the academy, because it's just a difficult place to be. Just with the academics and the credit hours and the military training and the athletics. And just so for me, that was actually really the toughest part.
I imagine this is the most true to life thing that you've worked on.
Definitely.
So was there a feeling that even the Hilo Dunker, were there certain things that you thought about where these are, I'm processing good memories and other things I'm processing not so good memories, but trying to put them together as a whole was a challenge?
Yes, there was both. And in fact, I went back and consulted my journals. And so if there were some things that weren't pleasant memories, I realized I had repressed them because I didn't even remember until I read the journal. I thought, oh gosh, one of the hard, it was a lot easier. It was actually very difficult to write this book. I wrote four books prior to Hover, three of which were epic fantasy. And so for those, it was easy. I mean, there's no rules. The laws of physics don't apply. I mean, you can do whatever you want. And suddenly when I decided to write this, now I knew too much. And it was difficult because I had to start and stop because I thought, well, that would never happen. And then I would start over and, well, that would absolutely never happen. And I was just getting in the way of myself. And finally, fortunately, my husband, he said, he was paraphrasing Tom Clancy, I think. He said, Anne, just write the damn story. And so I did. And that helped me to kind of get over that hump. But it was really tough and far more difficult to write than just the fantasy that I was writing before.
Yeah. Well, what about, tell us about the journals a little bit. I mean, did you keep those when you were in school?
I kept them in school, and I kept them when I was on deployment. So I have a treasure trove of stories. I mean, I don't even think I pulled 10% of what I could. I mean, there's a lot of material there for future novels, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I kept up through all my my deployments, so that was it was very interesting reading it over. I'd forgotten a lot of it, but it's good.
How long did you stay in the military?
Just over 9 years active duty.
Did the females have something in common other than the fact that they were pilots and they were good at that? Was there a certain personality, a certain approach you had to take based on the fact there were a lot more guys there?
We were pretty mellow, and I had a great group of girls in my first squadron. Competency was the name of the game. I don't know how else to put it, but they just did their jobs without a lot of drama, and we just, it was, so I would say we shared that in common. We were serious. We knew our stuff.
Tailhook was something that that a lot of people know about,
mm-hmm.
and it's in the book. Having been around when this was going on, what are your thoughts about it? What did it make you feel like?
The Tailhook scandal, it happened in 1991, and that convention and after-hours convention from the Tailhook Association just got a little out of hand, and there were several instances of sexual assault that came from that. And anyway, the fallout was, it rocked the Navy to the core. I mean, it was the Secretary of the Navy had to resign, and admirals were censured, and commanding officers lost their commands. I mean, it was bad. It was really bad. So I come out of flight school in 1992, right? It's like 5 months later. And so, and the thing is, so the whistleblower for the whole thing was a lieutenant, a female, a helicopter pilot. So the way that I felt that was kind of, you know, because now you're that person in a way. And so sometimes you kind of had to break through that initial hesitancy because they didn't know, I guess, what you were going to be like. And sometimes guys would walk on eggshells a little bit because they weren't sure what to say, what should I not say. But, you know, usually once we worked one-on-one and they realized that, like, you know, we could, I just did my job like anybody else, then it was usually okay. But it usually, you know, sometimes you had that initial hesitation, like just wondering what you were going to be like, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much of this, 1 to 10, 10 being this is Anne A. Wilson, absolutely all the way. How much of Sarah is you?
Oh, she's probably a 7.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a lot of me and her. Our personalities are very similar. I was the same way. I had a tough time with that. I was similar to Sarah in that I served on a ship. I was one of two women on this crew of 500. I didn't want to stand out as a woman, and I did everything in my power to not stand out. So that was no makeup, putting my hair back in a ponytail, very happy in a uniform. If we ever left the ship for liberty, you know, I never wore anything that looked feminine or dress or heels. And so I was like Sarah very much in that way. But then, you know, we have our differences. Sarah is, she's afraid of the water, actually. So that's completely different than me.
Now that you're a first-time published novelist, mm-hmm. how has that changed how you feel about yourself as a person? Are you starting to feel more comfortable with this idea of being kind of a public figure?
A little. This is definitely, I'm having to take this in stages. I'm very much an introvert. I'm very much a quiet person that would love to just hole up in the house all day long. You know, one of those classic writing hermits. That's definitely me. So yeah, this putting myself out there in the promotional sense is very new, and I know I have to do it, and it's getting better. You know, it's getting better, but it's very strange, because I remember someone had asked me originally, like, why don't you just write a memoir? And for me, I just, I can't even imagine. I cannot even imagine doing something. You know, that's too much me.
Yeah.
So this way, it's not quite all me, and it's okay that way.
Fountain Hills resident Anne A. Wilson, her first published novel came out in June. It's called Hover. We talked with her back in June. Some of it's based upon her experience as a Navy pilot, and she'll be speaking tonight at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. Reporters who were embedded with American military units chronicle the activities of those groups and the soldiers within them. Embedded photographers have a similar job, one that Robert Cunningham took up as he spent time with 40 different units in Afghanistan. The Valley-based Cunningham took 55,000 photographs, some of which ended up in the book Afghanistan on the Bounce. Robert, when you take photos of people in a war zone, how do you gain their trust to begin with?
You know, first and foremost, the primary thing is being with them and being present both, you know, emotionally, physically, and otherwise. You know, there's this idea of journalistic detachment But when you're standing next to somebody and you're getting shot at the same time they are, or you're, you know, they're holding, you know, your camera while they're holding their buddies that are hurt or otherwise, it's, you're there, you're intrinsically present. So that's the first step. But then there does have to be some back and forth conversations you have to have with people. You have to be able to be just as open with them as you want them to be with you, to where they can start understanding, is this the kind of person I want to be around? Is this the kind of person we want to have here? And there is always a battle. Every new unit I got with, every new group I was with, that rebooted. It's not just like, hey, that guy said I'm good. It's trying to work it up every time you get there.
I don't know how much you knew going in. I mean, obviously, we all have some knowledge of what's going on overseas. But once you get there and once you were embedded there, what did you learn that maybe just a basic fact you didn't know, or something that really surprised you?
You know, we all go into situations with preconceived notions. We go, what, you know, we had seen in the media, what we'd read, you know. I always had these ideas, and I knew that something wasn't right, because I sat with soldiers and service members, and they would watch the news with me, and they'd say, it's not what it is. So I knew that there was something not right, but all those preconceived notions I had, just about every single one of them had to go out the window within seconds of arriving in Afghanistan. When you step there and you look there and you realize the world you're in, you realize the difference of on base versus off base. You realize the differences between the little bases and the big base. The first major takeaway I had was, when somebody says they're in the military, you need to kind of go and down a little bit further and say, okay, what do you do in the military? What's your job like? Because there's people who never leave the wire. There's people who are always outside the wire. There's all kinds of different jobs and placements that people go through. And, you know, one of the first things that got me was, you hear in the media talk a lot about getting women into combat roles. And there's this idea that most of us have, it that women aren't outside the wire. But, you know, on almost every patrol I went on, we had females with us, or we interacted with females that were soldiers that were working with us. The idea that they're not present, they're not out there, that was one of the big notions that I looked at, and just patently false.
What is it like to take a photo of someone who may not survive, who this may be the last photo anyone ever sees?
You know, that was a realization I had to deal with very early on, unfortunately, in my first trip over there, out of the three that I've done so far. It was one of those mentalities that with my camera, I could capture something that would be snatched away with a bullet. It is a terrifying thing, and it's a huge responsibility, in my opinion. And, you know, unfortunately, there was times we lost people that I hadn't gotten photographs of, that I didn't. But then, you know, those times when you have something that you can hold on to and grasp, there is this, it's a very large part of what I do over there. In one of the responsibilities in my head was the realization that you're there for them, to tell their story, to show what they are and going through. And God forbid, if something happens and we lose them, that may be the last thing you can show their family. That may be the last thing that their family gets to hold on to.
How are you feeling after having taken photos, been involved as an embedded photographer? I mean, have you felt the impacts yourself?
Absolutely. I'm night and day different than when I was, who I was, you know, in July of 2011. You know, in July of 2011, as I was getting ready to go, you know, I have to admit there were some selfish reasons as why I wanted to. I had never served in the military, and, you know, I felt an inner need to go. And there was a lot of selfish reasons as to why I went in the first time. But then very quickly on, I sat with a soldier, and one of the soldiers talked to me. And as we were leaving, he said, thank you. And I looked at him and said, why? And he said, you make us feel important. And, you know, I couldn't sleep that night. I told him, I said, you are important, whether people make you feel that way or not. And, you know, it was a slap to my face to realize why I needed to be there and what the real purpose for being there was.
Robert Cunningham, he's the photographer behind the book Afghanistan on the Bounce. Robert, thank you so much for the time.
It was my privilege. Thanks for having me.
And that's all for today's Veterans Day-themed edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to you for listening. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on the program. If you didn't hear our full interviews with Navy pilot-turned-novelist Anne A. Wilson, embedded war photographer Robert Cunningham, or the family of Ernest McFarland, please go online later today at kjzz.org. You can also download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. It's a way you can podcast the program as well. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ, FM Phoenix, and HD. a service of Rio Salado College. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where specialists in neurology and neurosurgery work together to find innovative new ways to diagnose and treat patients with brain disorders. More at mayoclinic.org.